Know.com. Clarity about reality.
الحمد لله. الحمد لله رب العالمين. والصلاة والسلام على الرسول الكريم. وبعد. الحمد لله. What we're going to be looking at today is some 5 key events that occurred between the 12th of Rajab and the 12th of Sha'ban, respectively. This is talking about the month of May on the Gregorian calendar. One is the continued Mexican drug war and what that means for us looking over it from an international perspective. The second is the Saudi intervention, the Saud government intervention in Yemen. The third is the Moro Islamic Liberation Front entering into elections. The fourth major event is Daesh, which has been styled in English as ISIL or ISIS, but really Daesh has entered into Tadmor and started to destroy old ruins. And fifthly and finally is the cop killings that continue to go on in the United States and why we should be sharing an interest and with continued curiosity still be observing these events. The first I will talk about is the Mexican drug war and the gangs. In stories centered around Mexico, it is often put across that Mexico is awash with drugs and weapons because of it being a lawless and gun-toting society that is addicted to drugs. But a careful eye needs to be given before coming to such a rash conclusion. I would advise anyone who's able to look at the history of Mexico from the time of the Aztec peoples. So if you can study the history of the Aztec people, the building of Tenochtitlan, the organizing of these people, which were known as Mexica, which now we call Mexicans, these people that are Spanish-speaking, although Nahuatl is still widely spoken, the ancient Aztec language. If someone can do a study on this, they will find a startling amount of information that these people were not always in this condition. The Aztec people had an empire, perhaps the strongest in Central America, for more than 1,000 years. Its penultimate was with the Aztec consolidation. Then Hernando Cortes, Spanish conqueror and traveler, arrives, soldier of fortune. And the process begins where Spanish is forced upon the people. Smallpox is brought in and used as a form of germ warfare. We then move to another big milestone in history, which is where the Spanish consolidation of the Aztec Empire at one point gets sold off to a number of businessmen that are building what we now know as the United States. Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico. These states, Texas or Tejano, these states which were Azatlan, are sold off because they were being claimed as property of Spain. They are sold off and are now part of the United States, the empire that is currently ruling the world. Communism, when it makes its onward march from the writings of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels throughout Europe and into Central America in the form of a hearty socialism, comes to Mexico. So the people of Mexico attempt to fight against communism being forced upon them, and leaders being chosen from outside of them and put over them. These leaders are often classified as mestizo, which means that these leaders have the conqueror's blood in them and are ruling over a largely brown-skinned people. This has been the situation that Mexico has found itself in for quite some time. It has one of the highest populations in Mexico City. Some say it's 15 million, some say it's 20 million, counting all of them, all the actual Mexico City and all the suburbs surrounding it. One of the most densely populated places, most crowded cities in the world, along with Cairo. So then what is going on with these drug wars and these cartel and drug gangs? The great bulk of the drug war and the gangs in Mexico can be firmly placed in the lap of the United States, particularly the West Coast. We must go back to the 1950s and 60s when the gangs in the United States started. Two of them, which now have huge astronomical members in terms of comparison to other gangs. The gangs in the United States really on the West Coast are more like paramilitary organizations. One of these is the 18th Street, Yoshinta Trece. They were formed and are at between 25,000 and 50,000 members. The Hoover criminal gang, and particularly one section of this gang, the 74 Hoover criminal gang, which is 1,500 members. Another gang we have is the Mara Salvatrucha 13, which has been shortened to MS-13, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000 members. These gangs had their beginnings in the United States. And as they grew, their violence among and against each other also became more noticeable in the media. With the rise of crack cocaine in the early 1980s, declassified files indicate from COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the United States government, that drugs were intentionally distributed in Black, Latino, and in certain cases Arab neighborhoods to help augment the gang problem. So men before that only had a small cache of weapons now had full arsenals. Now, instead of the occasional drive-by shootings became the norm. People in Europe and other places dream of playing football or joining football teams or playing football in the summer. Children on the West Coast of the United States dream of being initiated into their neighborhood, doing their first killing. And so these gangs spiraled out of control. The drug war made it possible for this to occur on a much wider scale. Daryl Gates in the 1980s declared a war on gangs, saying that Nancy and Ronald Reagan's war on drugs was ill-advised and dubious because it wasn't pointing it at the necessary people. This is a war on gangs. And so the war began between the Men in Blue and the large gangs of the West Coast of the United States. So a 7-state insurrection stroke war began. One of the outcomes, well, two major outcomes of this were the following. One was called white vanning, which I've mentioned before, where gang members were marched out, taken hostage, and flown to different theaters of war that the United States is engaged in to fight on the battlefield on force and hopefully be killed and to be used as a warrior caste of efficient killers that was dispensable. Iraqi veterans of the Iraq War from 1990 as well as 2003 have brought back pictures of gang members and of gangbang graffiti from the West Coast of the United States on the backs of properties in Iraqi bazaars, on high-rise buildings, and how sometimes these gang members, if able to escape, would not only kill some of their commanding officers, but also killing local Iraqis. So the gang scene exploded and was brought out there. The second major outcome also was they decided to start deporting gang members. So someone who had been born in the United States, he was Chicano, a Mexican born in the United States. He had never been to Mexico, was deported. The same thing happened with blacks that had nothing to do with Mexico. They were just deported there. Arabs deported to Salvador. Why on earth would they be deporting these people to countries they were from but hadn't visited, or countries that they had no linkage to? The 18th Streets arrive in San Salvador and El Salvador. The Hoovers arrive. The Mara Salvatrucha 13, which had started in the United States and California as a way of Salvadorian immigrants protecting themselves from larger gangs, their members also get deported back to Central America. And so what happens? The gang scene metastasized to the point to where now, from Mexico all the way up to the 7 states of the West Coast, the gangbanging phenomenon is now manifest. In a strange twist of fate, what the United States thought was a clever way to get rid of their unwanted or undesirable elements, they wound up coming back to bite them. These so-called cartels still shout Mara Salvatrucha 13, 74 Hoover, or the Hoover criminals, or the Hoover homies, the 18th Street, 813, they still use these gang monikers, they still have the tattoos, the gang war, and there's connection and linkage between the guns running between California and Mexico, between Mexico and Texas, and all these other places. The gang war continues. Now, Mexico had had its own problems, but it did not have a transplant gang problem that was exacerbated by racism in the United States, made as an expat culture in their own country. That had not occurred before. But now there it was. So I strongly advise you to take a look at the fact that Mexico was awash with weapons. And the gangs that are coming into the United States, you have people of Mexico fleeing the gang scene. But it's a gang scene that was created in the United States. And so this disease, this cancer that is eating the inside out of the West Coast has come to Mexico. And the reason why it looks more stark than in the United States is not just reporting. It's because more of the Mexican family and conservative or traditional values are more entrenched in Mexican society than the United States. So it appears more extreme. And people, when they see things that are wrong, you have to remember the Mexicans created what was known as the liberation theology, which was a way of using their particular and peculiar form of Catholic Christianity to resist communism. So the Mexican people, or the Mexica people, they're no strangers to rising up when they see that there's something that's wrong. And every time someone that was a politician has tried to rise up, or every time a normal person or a community activist has tried to stand up against the mestizo rulers over them or the gangs that are transplants of the United States gangbang culture, they've been cut down brutally. This is why we're seeing these events. The next is the Ala Saud family intervention in Yemen. Now, we discussed before the Houthi rebels and the battle. Why is this important, and why is it now the case that the Ala Saud monarchy and the Iranian Guardian Council are on the edge of what could be military hostilities? Let's look at this. Both of these countries are supreme bearers of black gold, petroleum, oil. And both of them also have obscurantist and exotic theologies. The Ala Saud monarchy is no more than at most 300 years old. The Twelver Shia of Iran and the particular form that they've adopted is from the 4th century after the death of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It's no more than that where we have a complete theology. This particular form in which they believe that arms can be taken up against an oppressor and so forth in the Guardian's Council is from Ruhollah Khomeini al-Musawi, who elaborated on the doctrine of Wilayatul Faqih, the governance of the jurist. So a Guardian's Council was created, and the government is ruled by a Shia Marja. Both of these countries have this obscurantist and bizarre and exotic theology. They are both oil producers. They both, on average, print some 2 million pieces of literature in Arabic, Farsi, English, and a number of other languages, and disseminate all of this throughout the world. The battle that is going on in the Gulf with the demonstrations in Bahrain, Al-Bahrain and Qatar, the battle that's going on in Yemen is a battle not just for strategic position, but a battle for hearts and minds. Whoever controls the religion of the masses controls the minds of the people. So the question is, the Houthis who are Zaydiya, so they are not 12ers. But the question between these two powers is, in 20 years will they be Salafis? Or will they be Ithna Ashadi, Ja'fari, Shia? So the Ala Saud has interfered to fight against. The Iranians have used their influence to fund what looks like another proxy war. Now, this isn't the first proxy war that the Iranians have gotten involved in. The first proxy war was in 1982 in Lebanon, when then President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, pulled U.S. troops out of Lebanon after a series of terrifying suicide bombings, one of which involved a small white Japanese truck where the man came into the barracks and detonated himself and everything that was in the truck. This forever changed the U.S. understanding of relations in the Middle East. Ronald Reagan referred to those people as insane and sick. But these people were given funding and aid and religious instruction by the Guardian Council in Iran, Hezbollah being a satellite of a wider Ithna Ashari Shia ambitious project having its origin in Iran. So Iran wasn't physically on the battlefield, but their money was, their weapons were. And they were standing behind the curtain watching to make sure the puppet show went to plan. The second proxy war were the Arab uprisings in Syria around 2011 of the Gregorian calendar. Bashar al-Assad belongs to the Alawi branch of the 12ers, of the Alawi branch of the Shia, excuse me, which are one of the smaller minority groups within the Shia. But they still feel an affinity towards this man, and so they have had men on the ground. Both supporters and opponents of Bashar al-Assad mention Iranian intelligence advisors on the ground in Syria. Farsi being spoken by mediation groups. So this is another proxy war for Iran to secure a foothold in that area. The Ala Saud monarchy wants to continue its foothold by trying to keep the areas around it externally Salafi, or at least on the back foot so they can continue to distribute Salafi literature. On the east coast of the United States, especially in the 80s, if one was looking for a translation of the Quran, this was solely the responsibility of the Saud Embassy in Washington, D.C. No one could get you more translations than they could. No one had more literature than they did until 1989. Iranian literature was everywhere. The books of Ruhollah Khomeini were everywhere. All over the place. So this is a battle for hearts and minds. And to try to guarantee a future in 20 years that is either Salafi or Shi'i. My advice is to keep a very close eye on that area, because the Yemeni people themselves are nothing more than commodities in this theological circus. The next major event, because the Mexican drug wars have been going on for quite some time, but they entered the news on the 1st of May. On the 8th of May was the Saudi intervention beginning. But on the 9th of May, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front entered into elections to try to make its voice heard politically. The Moro Muslims of the Philippines, after being slaughtered by the Dutch and then the Americans, took up arms and formed the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. And for their attempt to defend themselves in their majority province of Mindanao, they were branded a terrorist organization. The Moro Islamic Liberation Front have never ventured out and flown planes into buildings in London or Los Angeles or New York. They've never sought to destroy landmarks in Canada. Their sole desire has been the autonomy that they originally possessed before the American and Dutch invasions. They have now entered the political sphere through elections and lobbying. My strong advice is for you to go online on Amazon and look up and obtain books about the history of the Moro people and the history of the Philippines, in which you will find pictures of fields of bodies of dead Moro Muslims. Gallows of men hanging. Bodies stacked up like cordwood of women and children, villagers, people who may have only been going to the well to get water to return home and never made it. Now these people have taken up arms to defend their homeland, and these people are terrorists. Smarting from his almost religious beating that he suffered by Floyd Mayweather Jr. in the ring, Manny Pacquiao, previous to that shellacking that he suffered on the 2nd of May, had visited the Queen of England, making it clear that the current status quo and structure of the political reality of the Philippines, i.e. no recognition for an autonomous region for the Moro people, will continue. None of the policies are going to change, and the Moro people shall remain as they are, wretched and in a state of utter degradation, leaving no option but guerrilla war or severe political lobbying, which they're attempting. So if one is able to obtain books on the Moro liberation, it's quite easy. If you go to your local library, you may find out these books probably have never been checked out, or they might have only been checked out once, because this is a forgotten portion of world history. No one thinks about the Moro people. Who are the Moros? What are they? Who cares? It's in the Philippines. Those people are just terrorists that have come from Afghanistan or whatever. The Moro people are not Arabs. They are not coming from Palestine or any of those areas. They are native people that have been fighting for years. Before it was called the Philippines, it was called something else. And they seem determined to maintain that original identity. The fourth point is we have Daesh entering into Palmyra, which had previously been known as Tadmor. Tadmor was known as the name of this city from the year 1000 BC. It is Semitic in origin. Tadmor is a type of tree that renders temer, which is dates. So Tadmor is a type of date tree, and temer is what comes from the Tadmor tree. And these Tadmor trees grow around the city of Tadmor. And this is why it was given this title by the Semitic people that had been native to the city. They've entered into Tadmor and started to destroy the ruins, because these belong to an idolatrous and shirky past in which the people did not know Allah and did not believe in the Messenger of Allah. Ignoring the fact that the Muslims that arrived there 1400 years ago did no such thing. Those ruins have stood there ever since the first Muslims had arrived, and they did nothing to them. In fact, there were big scholars that came from the city of Tadmor. There was a book written by the late Taqiyuddin ibn Taymiyyah. He died 7 to 8 Hijri, called Risala Tadmuriya, or Risala ila Tadmor, in which there was a discussion on creedal points and a number of other points. Tadmor had great scholars coming from among its ranks. It was a great city for scholarship and knowledge. In fact, Imam Shamsuddin ibn Muflih, rahimahullah, he died 763 Hijri, he mentioned that that was a place where you went to for medicine. But now, unfortunately, these places where we had old ruins of previous nations, it's thought that history needs to be erased, because as Muslims, our job is to erase the past that wasn't Muslim, rather than leaving those monuments which were not worshipped in place as markers and signs and symbols of previous nations. Just as Allah had said in the Quran, فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ عَقِبَةُ الْمُكَذِّبِينَ. So travel through the earth and see what was the end of those who had rejected faith aforetime. Well, how can you do that if all of those places are destroyed, devastated, and nothing remains but dust or ash? It defeats the purpose of being told in the Quran by Allah to travel through the earth and look at those places. Remember what happened. Look at the pyramids in Giza and the more than 200 further down the Nile. Look at the Great Step Pyramids in Central America, which are bigger than those in Egypt. Look at what happened to those people and why it happened, and take a lesson from that. Daesh aims to rewrite history. And I'd say this is no different than the French Egyptologist or the German Orientalist, who, by writing their own books on the topic, recreate a history which is digestible to themselves, and then they boil down that history and feed the giblets of it to the masses in the school system. Daesh is nothing but the revivification of the same process. The difference is the men who are doing this have peach fuzz on their faces and Kalashnikovs in their hands, but nothing in their minds. So you must understand that these monuments that were left, ask yourself this question. Why had they stood for 1,400 years before the coming of Daesh? Was it the case then that maybe the Muslims that had lived there previous to that time had a different understanding of Daesh? They had a different understanding of what Islam was? How did all those Christians wind up still being in Iraq before the coming of Daesh or in Syria? How did all those churches somehow manage to stay standing? How could this have happened? If Daesh is supposed to represent the golden age of taking us back to the visionary era of the righteous Salaf, why is it the two most important places in Christendom are in the very middle of the Muslim world in Palestine? The Church of the Holy Sepulchre and Church of the Nativity are both in Muslim areas. What are they doing there? What are they doing there? The oldest Aramaic-speaking Christian community in the world is in Syria. What's it doing there? Shouldn't those people have converted to Islam by now? The Chaldean and Jacobite and Nestorian communities of Iraq are some of the oldest Christian communities of history. What are they doing there? What's Egypt doing being between 10 and 20% Christian? Shouldn't they have all been killed by now? Apparently, those that arrived had a wholly different understanding to Daesh. Daesh is a different religion to what Muslims understand. They have another Muhammad, and this is Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. While the only Muhammad that a Muslim should be concerned with following is the Muhammad ibn Abdullah, who lived from 570 to 563, and not the wrong Muhammad. The fifth and final point were the cop killings that have been going on in the United States. To understand really the full perspective of this, I advise you to get a two-volume set entitled The Invention of the White Race by Theodore W. Allen. This two-volume set lays out how the invention of the white and black races was used as a legal brand in law to control people, to dominate, and how this brand was used by ruling classes to dominate over lower classes. The first place this experiment was done in was Ireland. The Irish were the world's first blacks in law. That's why you will sometimes meet people saying that they are black Irish, and sometimes they don't even realize the meaning of this expression. If you look at the legal discrimination, the invasions, the forced rape and other affairs that were carried out by the English crown against Ireland in the first volume of The Invention of the White Race, you will see the Irish, as mentioned by the author Theodore W. Allen, were the first blacks. They were the original Negroes. Once it was realized that this policy could be transferred across. It was then done in Scotland. The same process was transferred to the German treatment of Slavic people, in which Slavic to them was the same word as slave. And then it was transferred to the United States, where people being brought from West Africa in the 18th century were then labeled as blacks. And those ruling over them were called whites. And these legal brands were created. The 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th Amendments were then used by this ruling class to consolidate their hold over a legal class of people called blacks. And so people in the United States that answer to this title, colored, black, or Negro, can only vote using the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th Amendments. But they lose all other rights. The most important case to read on the topic of legal brands and the legal branding of the use black, legal use of the word black as a brand, was the Dred Scott case, in which Dred Scott attempted to obtain his freedom by using the fact that he was a black man and all blacks are free, just as whites are free. Judge Taney labeled the docket as plaintiff in error. Why? His ruling was the subject matter was absolutely correct in terms of the points that were put forward. The argument advanced by Dred Scott, all of that put forward was completely correct. But the status was wrong. Because Dred came into the court as Dred Scott, which is an English name. And he's not Scott. He only had that name because it was given to him by his master and he was property. And property cannot own property. And so he remained a slave. These black law codes are carefully and consistently being rolled out throughout the world. So the people that are engaging in the combat and fighting are correct to be fighting against the injustice because the subject matter is accurate, but the status is wrong. Muslims are engaged in fighting as well. And much of the statements that they make are accurate. The subject matter is accurate. But Muslims are coming as Democrats or socialists or other affairs. Status is wrong. And that is why they will always be defeated. Both books on the topic, The Invention of the White Race, are very hefty and will take you time to sit down and read and digest. But when you understand what's happened, you will understand internationally what's occurred. Right after that, digesting those two books, you then need to obtain the portable Hannah Arendt, which is Hannah, H-A-N-N-A-H, A-R-E-N-D-T. In which she explains that human rights declarations and human rights laws, she's a former, she had lived in Germany as a Jewish woman and suffered tremendously, escaped, came to the United States, and wrote about her findings and what she went through in Germany. She accurately showed that the human rights declarations and other laws are actually used to enslave people and not free them. Because her argument is the moment that someone can define your freedom, they can limit it. So after reading The Invention of the White Race by Theodore W. Allen, both volumes, I advise you to read The Portable Hannah Arendt or any works by Hannah Arendt, particularly her writings on what's known as totalitarianism and how she accurately predicted that this would be the ultimate fate of the United States. I advise you strongly to obtain this literature to understand accurately what's going on. Because without understanding accurately what's going on, then you will still begin to wonder, why are these people being shot down the street by police? Why is this happening? Because these people are being defined as a legal caste. They have no standing in law, and so you can do whatever you want to these people. And as long as people keep defining themselves in terms of how they have been defined by someone else, then you have nothing to expect but more terror and more suffering. And as a final point, I'd say as well, as long as you are monolingual, you have nothing to expect but more chaos and deception. If you are only fluent in English, you have no other means of critiquing the world and understanding accurately what's going on around you, because you are only able in the marketplace of ideas to use one type of ticket. And that should never be the case for anyone. You should always seek to be bilingual at the very least, so you can accurately gauge what is going on in the world in more than one language, so you cannot be controlled. If someone controls the language, they control how you think. If they control how you think, they do not have to put their hands on you to beat you, because you're already mentally broken. Like the case of the zookeeper and the African elephant, from the time the African elephant was a calf, he had tied it to a small sapling to make sure that the African elephant calf did not escape to another location. When it got to be as a full-grown adult, he was asked by another keeper, why do you keep tying it to that sapling, when in reality it could just pull it out of the ground and walk on? He said, no, it's not going to do that, because from the time it was a calf, I've been tying it to that sapling. And so it has it in its mind that it can't do that. It still thinks of itself as that African elephant calf. Are you that African elephant calf? You have to gather knowledge. And so if you can gather knowledge, my advice would be, if you are not fluent in any language other than English, to consider Spanish or Mandarin Chinese, which are coming up on the horizon soon. So I say in this, أقول قبل هذا أستغفر الله لي ولكم أستغفر الله إن الله غفور رحيم يرحم الراحمين ولا إله إلا الله.
Know. Clarity about reality. See more at know.com.